You're listening to Security Squad, top IT security trends and issues of 2007 for December 20th, 2007.
And devices like that, they're not enterprise devices yet. I mean, a lot of people may have an iPhone, but they're not using it for business purposes. Hopefully, they're not storing a lot of important data on there either.
They are starting to sell off pieces of the botnet itself. This is the future. This is what the future of malware looks like. And it's not a pretty picture. It's going to get worse and worse over the next couple of years as more and more malware authors see the kind of economics that are involved in this.
A company really isn't going to take their security seriously unless one of two things happen. One, that you're forced through regulatory compliance to make some changes, or two, you do end up getting hit like TJX did.
Welcome to Security Squad. I'm Rob Westerveld, and we have several people in the studio to talk about the top information security issues of 2007. Joining us is Mike Momoso. Mike's editor of Information Security Magazine. Mike, you've been busy working on the 10th anniversary edition of Information Security. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what really will be the focus of the upcoming issue?
We talk to the people, the important innovators. We talk about the important technology of the last 10 years. We talk to every luminary we could think of and try to bring you the best stories we could from the last 10 years.
Cool. Well, that'll be available in January.
That's correct.
Joining us is Dennis Fisher. Dennis is executive editor of CertSecurity.com and Information Security Magazine. Dennis, you recently wrote an interesting blog entry about the changing role of the CISO.
Well, that sort of came out of a panel that I was on a couple months ago at our Information Security Decisions Conference. And I think the basic point I was trying to get across is that the CSOs who I've spoken with and who were in the room that day were saying that most of the time, their job these days has almost nothing to do with the technical aspects of security. It's more about management and especially risk management and dealing with the upper level executives in their organizations and trying to get them to see the importance of security. And most of the day-to-day tasks are being left to the lower level security folks, but. Mm-hmm. A lot of the CSOs who were in the room that day didn't even have technical backgrounds. Most of them were line of business managers who just happened to be in the CSO role at that point.
And finally, we have Bill Brenner, and Bill is senior news writer for Cert Security. Bill, you've been fresh off of your multi-part series examining Windows Vista deployments. Talk briefly about the takeaway from that reporting. Are more people deploying Vista now, or what are some of the major issues?
Sure. Well, we've been talking all year to different IT shops from different industries, and most are moving very slowly on their company-wide deployments of Vista, and there are two reasons behind it. The biggest is that a lot of their homegrown applications, business programs that they need to get their daily work done doesn't play well with Vista, and so they have to do a lot of tweaking to their homegrown programs, which takes time, and then in other cases, some of their other vendors weren't ready for Vista, and that has slowed things down considerably. And so a lot of them are looking at mid to late 2008 before they really get serious about deploying across the companies.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill. Let's get right down to it. We're going to talk about some of the top security issues and the trends of 2007, and maybe a little bit about what's ahead in 2008. And the first thing on our list is PCI DSS, the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standards. We've talked about this a number of times, especially on Security Squad. And we know that there were several deadlines this year, well, a couple of deadlines this year. September 30th was the deadline for Level 1 businesses. Those are the big guys, the Amazon.coms, the eBays, and a lot of the big box retailers. They had to meet the deadline. And Level 2 businesses, they have until the end of December to have their security up to standard. Those are businesses that process 20,000 to 6 million credit card transactions. Now, we've already heard some firms are getting extensions. What do you guys think is the year ahead? What's going to happen to PCI DSS? Bill, why don't you cover that since you've been really reporting on this pretty closely?
I think the year ahead is, frankly, more of the same. This past year, I talk to a lot of IT auditors and a lot of IT departments about how they were faring, how people are faring with PCI DSS, and most told me they were doing fine. That, yeah, there were some areas that they had to work on, but as long as you have a plan showing how you're going to address some of your shortcomings, you know, the PCI police aren't going to come down and tear away your ability to take credit card transactions. But on the other hand, there have been a lot of surveys that have come out in the last 3 months talking about how a lot of respondents that they talk to are having a lot of trouble getting into compliance. So my sense is the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, and that it depends on the size of your company and what your resources are to get around the problem.
Dennis, what's your take? Do you think that some of these surveys that have come out saying that the companies, you know, need to purchase more technology to comply at a certain deadline, and we do have the December deadline coming up, do you think this is just vendor FUD, and do you think the year ahead will bring a lot more spending from retailers and from other merchants?
Yeah, I think it probably will. A lot of that probably is just sort of vendor architecture kind of stuff, saying if you really want to be in compliance, you have to have this software package or this set of tools in place. But I wouldn't be surprised next year to see the PCI Council toughen up the rules a little bit. They've taken a lot of criticism from folks like us and other people, consultants and auditors, about the fact that the rules aren't necessarily that tough. There's been some crowing from smaller companies that have to comply with the regulations, saying, oh, you know what, it's too tough for us, or something along those lines. And Bill's right. The auditors say, as long as you've got a little map showing, you know, we're trying hard, they won't give you trouble. But, you know, that's like bringing home an F on your report card and saying, but Dad, you know, you see me in my room studying every night, you know, I'm trying. So, you know, it can't be that bad, right? I mean, the reality is at some point they have to say, okay, enough is enough. You're not meeting these rules that we've set out for you. Here are the consequences. And right now there don't seem to be any consequences, unless your name shows up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal for a data breach or something along those lines, then you get a fine. But until then, you seem to be okay as long as you have some sort of plan.
We've heard a lot about encryption too come up with PCI DSS. Do you think 2008 is going to bring more companies deploying encryption? And where does encryption fall right now in terms of the adoption cycle?
Yeah, I would hope so. I'm not convinced that it's going to happen. There still seems to be a perception among enterprise IT staffs that encryption is difficult, it's complex, it's hard to deploy, and for what you get out of it, it's not necessarily worth all of that effort. But I think that's sort of a, you know, 1999 mentality. There's a lot of pretty easy to use encryption products out there, especially things like full disk encryption and file level encryption. If you're talking about, you know, PKI bridges and things like that, yeah, that can be complex. But file level and disk level encryption products are pretty simple to deploy these days and pretty user friendly. So I think that's a little bit of a cop-out on the part of users that are shying away from that.
Mike, are you hearing anything from readers in the magazine on this?
Well, sure. I mean, I think Dennis is right. I think you're going to see that the rules have to be toughened up a little bit. But in the same regard, they have to continue to provide some guidance. I mean, there was some recent guidance on help with application development. There was a standard that was issued. And as long as they provide some best practices and some guidance, that I think that companies will continue to move forward on this.
Well, this obviously brings us to data breaches, and that's the crux behind the PCI DSS standard. There was a recent report from the Poneman Institute that outlined that costs are rising with data breaches, and we kind of hear that every single year. Yeah. They've been tracking that over the last couple of years. Why don't you talk about that, Bill? Is there really one solution on the horizon?
Well, first, I don't know about one solution on the horizon, though there'll be a lot of vendors that will come out and claim to have that one size fits all. The main message that I tend to hear again and again is that a company really isn't going to take their security seriously unless one of two things happen. One, that you're forced through regulatory compliance to make some changes, or two, you do end up getting hit like TJX did, and that forces you to make some changes. Now, the Poneman Institute, every year the news of their report is the costs are going up, up, up. And I think that's simply because more and more companies are having to disclose. And
Mike, do you think 2007 is the year of the data breach, or do you think this it's been building up over the last couple of years?
Oh, it's definitely been the last couple of years. I mean, it started with ChoicePoint, Veterans Administration, TJX. I mean, this is definitely going to be the year of TJX, I think, more than data breaches as a whole. This is, you know, set a whole new low as far as how many records were lost. The fines levied against TJX were pretty big. Yet, overall, their cost per record wasn't as high as what Poneman Institute's numbers usually show. So there's a discrepancy there that needs to be looked at. But yeah, definitely, I think it's more so the year of TJX, and it'll be interesting to see what happens once some of these class action lawsuits come through and where the ultimate cost ends up being passed along, if it ends up being with TJX or with the banks or with the consumers. There's still a lot of questions to be resolved.
You know, I think the best opportunity for TJX to suffer a real financial blow is through a lot of these class action lawsuits, and I think that's why you saw them a week or two ago putting out this settlement offer. And I think that's TJX trying to head off the real potential damage ahead. It'll be interesting to see if the banks say okay.
Let's just talk briefly about one of those areas from TJX was Wi-Fi security and the whole issue around a WEP and WPA. Where are most companies right now in terms of their Wi-Fi security? Does anybody have any idea? Do you have any idea, Dennis? Or do most companies have WPA implemented if they're using Wi-Fi?
Yeah, I think so. I think in an enterprise deployment of a Wi-Fi network, most of the gear that you buy these days, you would, if it's newer than 5 years old, you probably don't even have the option of using WEP. You know, it's WPA at the very least, you know, WPA 2 more likely. So hopefully most of the people who have those networks have WPA turned on. There's definitely still some open wireless networks out there, and I think people have come to grips with the fact that, you know, if you do leave your, you know, if it's not your corporate network, I mean, we're all in airports and in coffee shops and places like that all the time, and it's almost impossible not to find an open network still. I think people that are running those networks have found, you know what, as long as it's just people borrowing my internet access, I don't care. If they can, as long as you have the back end of your network protected, if they're just sharing your internet connection, you're not in much danger.
Well, the next issue that we brought up was mobile security, and I wanted to ask you about this, Mike. More users seem to be turning to smartphones, and we've got the Apple iPhone that made a big hit this year. Do you think 2008 will bring on a major spike in mobile malware? And we seem to hear that almost at the end of every single year that mobile malware is going to be a big hit.
Probably not. The iPhone and devices like that, they're not enterprise devices yet. I mean, a lot of people may have an iPhone, but they're not using it for business purposes. Hopefully they're not storing a lot of important data on there either. So then it becomes a policy issue on what devices you can bring into your network and so forth. But as far as mobile malware, I mean, that's been kind of tossed around for years, but no one's really seen any practical, actual, in-the-wild deployments of a mobile virus that have gained any traction anywhere. I think in terms of mobility, if you're talking problems, I mean, we've hit on it a couple of times. It's laptops. There's a lot of data that's left on laptops, and a lot of laptop encryption projects are probably going to happen this year. We just did our priority survey of our readers, and I believe it was in the neighborhood of 30% were evaluating laptop encryption projects this year, and another 15 or 16% had already deployed laptop encryption. So that's definitely getting a lot more attention.
They're probably worried about stolen laptops, right?
Right. And I mean, if you encrypt your laptop and you lose it or it gets stolen, I think Bill said it earlier, it's a paperweight.
Yeah. And that brings us a little bit to the iPhone, and I wanted to ask you about this, Dennis. As it picks up market share, do you think it will be a bigger target? Arbor Networks predicts, they just came out with a report predicting that the seriousness of attacks on the iPhone will increase in 2008. It could be because Apple plans to release the iPhone API to developers in February. I'm asking you this because you seem to have some connections there with the white hacker community. Do you think that they feel more of a challenge to really crack the iPhone and that makes it more vulnerable?
I think at first they certainly did. I mean, we saw a lot of activity around it this summer right after it was first released. There was all kinds of traffic on mailing lists and, you know, messages going back and forth about, you know, I think within a few hours of its release, somebody had found the root password on it and, you know, people just saw it as another, another challenge, something to play with for a little while. But I think the point you brought up about them releasing the API and, you know, at some point releasing a software development kit for the iPhone platform, that's going to make all the difference in the world. Once that kind of stuff is out there, then all of a sudden the good guys and the bad guys have some actual code to play with. You know, right now, there's not a great way to get at the underlying code on the iPhone. But once they release an SDK and an API, then they can sort of go through that and reverse engineer and see where some of the vulnerabilities lie. So I think that's probably one reason why Apple is being careful and sort of methodical about when they release that kind of stuff, because they know that is a danger, and they want to make sure that they're as careful as they can be with it before they put it out on the streets.
Of course, it's going to be really interesting to see how they release the API. I mean,
right. It'll probably be attached to some sort of other download that you have to take that'll, you know, ruin everything you've done to your iPhone at this point and, you know, make you rebuy your iTunes songs or something.
Bill, we seem to have seen a number of iterations of the Storm in 2007. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and what you think we're going to see moving into 2008? Are we going to see more of the same?
I definitely think so. And one reason is because of all the success the bad guys have had using all of these Storm malware variants to grow these enormous botnets. And then we started seeing Storm in January, and then this past fall, we started seeing, Dennis, I think you wrote the story about how now pieces of the botnet were being broken off and sold. So now you have, they created this big monster and they're chipping off pieces that can be used and customized.
Dennis, do you have anything to expand on that?
Yeah, I'm actually in the middle of trying to finish this long story I've been doing on Storm and some other peer-to-peer malware that's shown up this year. And the main thing that I think people need to understand about Storm and Nugash and other pieces of malware like this is that they are there for one specific purpose, and that's to make money for their authors. They're not there to, wreak havoc. They, the authors don't want them to be found. They've got all kinds of stealthy features in them. The recent versions of Storm will encrypt all of the drivers that they're installing on a compromised PC so that it's harder to find the Trojan itself. They do RSA key exchange between the peers, encrypting all of their traffic. If you find one of the command and control servers on the Storm botnet and are able to take that down, it doesn't matter because all of the peers are equal in this botnet. So another one can just take over and start sending out the files needed to infect other PCs. So the really scary thing about these is that they're being written by professional developers. All the researchers who I've talked to about this have said, listen, this is being run like any other software development project. There's quality assurance, there's testing, there's revisions, there's all kinds of, it's clear that these guys are trained software engineers who are writing this. This is not junk code. It doesn't have errors in it. You don't find mistakes the way they did in Code Red or Blast or things like that. This is professional, high-quality software, and they're selling it for high prices. They are, starting to sell off pieces of the botnet itself. And I think this is just, as Bill said, this is the future. This is what the future of malware looks like. And it's not a pretty picture. It's going to get worse and worse over the next couple of years as more and more malware authors see the kind of economics that are involved in this and how simple it can be to do something like this if you've got the skill.
Yeah, one interesting thing about that is I paid a visit to Kaspersky Lab, their U.S. office, this year and sat down with Eugene Kaspersky. And one of the questions I asked him, I said, you're from Russia. A lot of the malware is coming from Russia. Can you talk about the culture and how it is that this has become such an industry there? And the way he described it was very interesting to me because his take is that a lot of the people developing this kind of stuff, they don't consider themselves hackers or criminals. they think of themselves like arms manufacturers. They're building these things. Somebody else is going to blow them up. They're not the ones who are going to, you know, pull the pin or press the button. And so they feel they're morally that their hands are clean because somebody else is going to use them. And that's a big problem because there's this huge moral flexibility out there that allows some of the smartest people in the world to make these things and make them more and more ironclad.
Money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most interesting factoid tidbit I heard this year about the Storm was that it had the equivalent power of one of the top 10 supercomputers in the world. And I think that paints a pretty drastic picture of how dangerous it is. And it's his own cottage industry. Like Dennis said, it's being chopped up and sold off, and it's being professionally developed. And that's what we're going to have to deal with in the next few years anyway.
The other thing is that the really well-known ones like Storm are really just sort of the public face of this problem. There's all kinds. There are thousands and thousands of skilled developers out there writing this kind of software. And as Bill said, a lot of them don't consider themselves to be, you know, on the wrong side of the line. They're just writing software, and what you use it for is your business. I mean, that's been going on for decades. I mean, there's programs out there like Back Orifice and Sub 7 that are considered rootkits, but have other legitimate uses too. But there are people out there writing sort of custom Trojans like Storm, but that are targeted at specifically financial institutions in one country, for example, and are targeting that financial institution's customers with very specific, you know, almost impossible to decipher messages to tell that they're fake. There's no way to tell these are fake. They're using, you know, they're like the best phishing message you've ever seen. And then you, on top of that, if you happen to click on the link, you're getting a Trojan installed that's not only pulling down your username and password from the banking site, but anything else that you've got on your computer that's unprotected. So there's all kinds of stuff like this out there that's that you're not hearing about at this point. Storm just happens to be the loudest one at the table right now.
Dennis, I wanted to ask you this one about security researchers and how you would sum 2007 up. Are they gaining more respect?
I think some of them are. A lot of the researchers who have been at it for a long time, you know, say 8 or 10 or 12 years, at least the ones who I know well, a lot of them have either moved on to full-time legitimate jobs and are, you know, working at startups or have been hired by Microsoft or other, you know, big software shops who value their expertise. And in those cases, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been seen as a total sellout move by the security community, and they would have had, you know, lost all credibility within the, you know, the sort of security underground. But these days, people see that as, you know, okay, if they can go inside these companies and make a difference, then no problem. And if they can get, there's a finite number of people in the world that have the kind of skills that these guys have, and if they can get paid, then let them get paid. You see guys like David Litchfield, who, you know, 6 or 7 years ago was just starting out and now is considered the top database security expert in the world, basically a self-taught guy, and is, you know, a sought-after speaker and for all kinds of topics. I think a lot of these guys have done themselves favors in sort of pulling back from, they used to just sort of walk right up to that line of, you know, white hat, black hat, and sometimes step over it in terms of releasing exploit code, all of that kind of stuff. And you really don't see that much anymore. There's a really small pool of guys who still do that kind of thing. And for the most part, it's in very limited and very closely knit circles. It's not on bug track anymore. It's not on, you know, full disclosure. It's much more undercover than it used to be. So I think a lot of these guys have sort of come into their own and gotten a lot of credibility and sort of gone into the mainstream, yeah.
One thing that I thought maybe was a bit of a black eye for them was the whole incident at DEF CON with the MSNBC producer that was outed,
yeah.
And then there was a lot of YouTube videos out there that really showed the producer getting booed and kicked out and everything.
Yeah.
Do you think that was just it's forgotten about at this point, or do you think it really was a little bit of a black eye on the community.
I don't know. I think that was sort of that's the kind of sort of high school stuff that used to go on at DEF CON and Black Hat all the time. I mean, that kind of – they used to have a spot the Fed contest at Black Hat where they, you know, go around and tag guys who were obvious government employees and that kind of thing. So this is just – I think it's just sort of, you know, locker room antic type things. I mean, it was definitely a little over the top. In my opinion, but it's sort of characteristic of the way that you get 1,000 guys in a room, and that's the kind of thing that's going to happen, you know?
All right, 2007 seemed to be a year where we saw a lot of industry consolidation, a lot of the big players gobbling up point solutions to fill out the white spaces in their portfolio. Mm-hmm. Mike, why don't you talk a little bit about that, what you saw, and do experts say that the trend will continue moving into 08?
It's definitely going to continue. I think looking back on 2007, a few years from now, we might see this as the turning point when the standalone security market maybe started to go away a little bit. This is going to be remembered as the year that Google got into security big time. IBM picked up WatchFire, HP picked up Spy Dynamics, you see the offshoot of the continuation of the integration of RSA into EMC. These big infrastructure players are paying a lot of attention to security. They're spending a lot of money in it, and this is probably just the beginning. I'm sure it's just the beginning.
Then it's the same thing. I mean, we've seen this trend happen over the last probably 5 or 6 years, even maybe even longer than that, right?
Yeah, it's kind of gone in fits and starts. Right after 9/11, there was a huge influx of venture money into the security community. So there were a ton of startups that came out of that time frame, and a lot of those have either gone away or been acquired. And then there was a little bit of a lull, and now it's certainly picked back up again. But I think Mike's right. I think this is sort of the beginning of what may be the end of the standalone security industry. It's I think there will always be independent security companies. I don't think that's going to go away 100%. But in the long term, it seems impossible that security is not going to be a feature that's built into, you know, both hardware and software over time. It doesn't make sense to be adding it on later. It doesn't work as well as it could if it's built into the software from the beginning or the hardware. You know, a lot of companies have been trying to push that message for years. Most of them, like Microsoft or, you know, Cisco or IBM, obviously have a stake in this game. But to Microsoft's credit, I think they've been talking about this for a long time. And, you know, I think they're right in the fact that, you know, this Palladium project that they announced, it's got to be 5 years ago now.
What is that?
It essentially was their shot at building security into the hardware itself and drawing a clear line from the security modules in the hardware to the software that's running on the computer to make sure that both of them were both, you know, legitimate, and that nothing malicious was running on, only trusted processes could run on this computer. Mm-hmm. But it depends on hardware security modules, and a lot of people had privacy concerns and other kinds of problems with it. The name has changed, and it's got some unpronounceable name right now that's escaping me, but I think that
it's a
kind
symbol,
of,
right?
Yeah, right. It's a symbol like Prince, yeah. But I think that kind of that architecture has a lot of benefits both for the manufacturers and for the consumers. If you know, you don't really think about the analogy that some of these vendors always use is the utilities in your house, you know, water, lights, that kind of thing. They just work. You don't think about whether your phone's going to work when you pick it up, but you know, you do think about whether your computer's going to attack you when you turn it on. I mean, you're always sort of holding your breath to see what's going to happen. As I said, I think it's going to be almost impossible that this doesn't happen over the next, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the time frame is, but, you know, 3 to 5 years doesn't seem too ambitious to me.
That ends this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For Mike Mimoso, Dennis Fisher, and Bill Brenner, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a happy and healthy new year.